Welcome back to the second season of the Open Update. For Liberate Science, I'm your host, Chris Hartgrink. And in this season, we interview 10 guests over the course of 9 weeks about the UNESCO recommendation on open science. A different setup in our virtual studio today, as we are interviewing multiple people at the same time, a first in the Open Update. And we'll be talking today about the future of research work, especially in light of the UNESCO recommendation on open science. And who better to talk to about the future of research work than the next generation of researchers? Joining us for this episode of the Open Update are Meng Liu and Shilan Al-Zahavi, all early career researchers and part of the award-winning FORT project. Meng Liu is a PhD candidate at the Faculty of Education, University of Cambridge, and a Methods Fellow at Cambridge Digital Humanities, and she focuses on the psychology of language learning, co-convenes Open Applied Linguistics, and was chief editor of the graduate-led Cambridge Educational Research e-Journal, where she champions open and accessible research. And second, we're joined by Shilan Al-Zahavi. She is a master's student in statistics and a PhD candidate in organizational behavior at Stanford University. She's also a part of the Stanford Center for Open and Reproducible Science, where she promotes the adoption of open science practices and, for example, helps people traverse spooky things like version control. So welcome, Shilan, to the Open Update. Meng, welcome to the Open Update.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
So it's fantastic that you're joining here. We also had Flavio Avezedo originally planned, and he couldn't make it. But we're going to have this conversation about the future of research work, so in light of the UNESCO recommendation. And I want to kick us off by getting your perspective on a key question around this new policy document. And, you know, it comes with 193 countries who say, yes, we want to support this. And throughout this series, we've been asking all kinds of people the same question. And I want to ask this question of you as well, first to Shilan and then to Meng. So from your perspective, what is a low-hanging fruit of the UNESCO recommendation on open science, and what do you think is going to be a particularly difficult thing to realize?
The recommendation expresses the goal of open scientific knowledge, which comprises access to publications, data, software, code, and open educational resources. Of these, I feel like open educational resources is the lowest hanging fruit. The open educational resources movement is already well established and has been for years. Most of us have heard about MOOCs, or massive online open courses, like Coursera, edX, and Khan Academy. More and more, I also see educational books like books on programming and statistics that are published in print by traditional publishers, but that come with a free online version, or books that completely do without an in-print version and are simply available for free online. In terms of some of the more difficult things to realize, open access to publications has to be implemented by publishers and journals, which are often for-profit, and it has to be implemented in a way that is fair and inclusive to researchers. I'm sure that many of us remember the outrage that followed when Nature revealed the terms of publishing open access in some of their journals, which includes an article processing fee for authors of over $11,000. And that's simply infeasible for the large majority of researchers and completely goes against the spirit of this recommendation on open science, which is all about accessibility and inclusivity. To me, one of the ideas behind open science is to promote inclusion and access for traditionally underrepresented groups, and outrageous article processing fees just further promote inequalities in scientific publishing. So we might respond by saying, let's stop submitting there and move to other journals that are more aligned with our values. But the unfortunate truth of the matter here is that so long as researchers are evaluated on traditional metrics like impact factor, they're going to want to submit to these prestigious journals. And that brings up what I think is the biggest challenge here, which is simply the incentives and reward structure for individual researchers. For example, the recommendation refers to open software and code, But so long as researchers are not systematically rewarded in academia for these non-traditional outputs, then it's just unrealistic to expect uptake of these recommendations. Software requires active and often very time-consuming maintenance. So who's going to take on this task if it's unpaid and everyone's already overburdened with research, teaching, and service commitments? We need funding for the maintenance of open science practices, including those that traditionally go unrecognized by universities and promotion committees. The recommendation talks about the economic benefits of open science practices, but it's individual researchers who have to implement these practices and who bear the costs of implementing them. So we need to be talking about the costs and benefits of open science practices for individual researchers and the potential unintended negative consequences of open science practices, like these extraordinarily high article processing charges. As social scientists, we know that any intervention to a system can have unintended consequences, and we should be evaluating the impact of science reforms.
That's a very fascinating perspective. I definitely haven't heard from anyone saying in this series that the low-hanging fruit is open educational resources. So I would love to dig in a bit more about that. Also, how it relates to these incentives that you say are one of the harder things to realize. So Meng, I'm very interested in this twofold interview to get your perspective.
Yeah. First of all, I would like to thank Shilan for a very comprehensive answer, which touches upon many points mentioned in the UNESCO recommendation, and I don't think I need to repeat them here. So perhaps I can touch upon a little bit of the things that are different from what Shilan has covered. So first of all,
she didn't steal your answer. Sorry for interrupting.
That's a good thing in a way, because there are many consensus already. So I have to say, first of all, my reaction to this question is that I'm not so sure if there are any sort of true low-hanging fruits when it comes to open science, simply because it is so wide-ranging and all-encompassing, as reflected in the definition of open science in the UNESCO recommendation already. Now, having said that, if I have to pick one low-hanging fruit, I believe it is to get more people engaged in the discussion of open science. While the UNESCO recommendation is a huge milestone of progress in open science, which is a great example of open dialogue at the international level, but at the same time, we also need to recognize that we are still at the beginning of this journey. We are still only starting to scratch the surface when it comes to opening up research and scholarship. The harsh reality is, at the current moment, there are still many people who are simply not included or engaged in this conversation. And not without good reasons, actually. For example, the term open science itself has traditionally been very exclusive and may discourage researchers in the humanities, for example, to engage with this construct, which is why the term open research or open scholarship is often preferred, as they are more inclusive. Now, things like being mindful of the connotations of the language we use and to invite more people to be included in the discussion on open science so that their voices can be heard should be the very first steps we take. Just like the UNESCO initiated open discussions with its nearly 200 member states at the international level, we should do the same at other levels as well, such as within our own research groups, our research institutions, disciplines, regions, or nations. Now, again, you may have already anticipated this. I think there are many difficulties or challenges when it comes to open science. But one of the most difficult tasks, I would say, is equity and inclusivity in open science. And I'm not just talking about injustices such as the digital divide. You know, when we do open science, the way we do open science now is very much focused on online platforms, open access to data and to papers, things like that. But such practices can be very exclusive and alienating for researchers who have no internet access or lack the technical skills to use digital tools. I'm also talking about epistemic justice. That is how we can make sure that the different forms of knowledge production and different ways of knowing are being valued equally. For example, there are many sort of guidelines or best practices being of open science being promoted. Now, when people or when we promote certain ways of knowledge production as best practices, I think we need to be mindful of the implications and consequences of such actions to reflect on whether we are actually marginalizing certain ways of knowing and knowledge systems and unintentionally perhaps reinforcing the inequalities and injustices already existent in the current ecosystem of science.
So I'm intrigued now. There's so many associations I've had, but this interview is about you. So how do you see the points that you've already raised in your own work in that sense? And how does the perspective of the other influence your own thoughts right now?
Yeah, I guess I can answer two questions at the same time. So first of all, you seemed surprised that I brought up open educational resources as a low-hanging fruit. And then Meng also mentioned that she thinks that there maybe are no such thing as low-hanging fruits in open science. You know, there's a big burden on researchers. It's a lot to ask, and it's a very diverse, multi-component process. And I think it's very fair to get pushback on this specific point. And I also want to respond to what Meng said about diversity. So first, let me mention open educational resources. One reason why I think this may be a bit more of a low-hanging fruit and why it has already seen quite some implementation, at least in my perspective, is that teaching is more traditionally aligned with what promotion and tenure committees take into account than some of these more novel proposals like open source software and open code and data. There's already a strong existing infrastructure for open educational resources, and we all do it, right? We all teach. So I think it might be easier to just take what we already do and start sharing it openly so that you can now put it on your CV that your online course or your book has had this many clicks and this many likes and this many downloads. But again, I think it's very fair to push back on my point and to ask, might it be naive to see this as a low-hanging fruit, right? And this brings me to another example, which is open data. So in the recommendation, the reuse of data seems to be described as a universally good thing. And if you'd asked me about open data a week ago, I would have said, sure, that's a low-hanging fruit. Everyone benefits and everyone is happy. But thanks to academic Twitter, I realized that this perspective was perhaps a bit naive and that there actually are a number of researchers who worry about early career researchers spending years collecting data and accessing hard-to-reach populations, all to have their open data be reused without citation or attribution. And I think that's something we have to be mindful of. This goes back to Meng's point about diversity and inclusion. We have to think about the diversity of disciplines and how it's impossible to implement a one-size-fits-all approach to open data and to open science more generally. In some cases, data collection is costly or sharing data is difficult due to ethical issues, intellectual property concerns, or a lack of resources. In my field specifically, data collection can be quite cheap and easy if you're willing to rely on online participant pools. But of course, there are other fields in which it is much more time consuming and costly to collect data. And it's impossible for me to say how I would feel in that situation about my data being freely used by others without proper citation or attribution.
And could you share a bit more about what happened between last week and this week? I hear you say Twitter.
I'm not sure if I actually changed my own opinion on this, but at the very least, I was confronted with the reality that there's no consensus about it. I think that if we would have had this interview a week ago and you would have asked me how people feel about open data, I think I would have said something about there being a consensus. But the truth of the matter is that I'm impacted by the social environment that I'm in, and I do research in social psychology and organizational behavior, and most people around me collect their data from MTurk, from Prolific, and from other online participant pools. So I'm simply not confronted with the reality for some researchers where it's really hard for them to collect data. And that's what this Twitter discussion made me realize. I believe that there was a woman who just openly asked someone's perspective or academia's perspective on the fact that someone had used their data without reaching out, I believe, is the story. And of course, there were a bunch of quote tweets and responses where you could really see a diversity in the replies, in the responses. And that was a wake-up moment for me that no, not everyone agrees on this, and very understandably so, right? For me, it was very insightful to realize that we don't all come from the same place. We don't all have the same resources. We don't all take the same amount of time to collect data. And so for some people, it simply is a bigger ask than for others. And that is something we have to take into account.
It's very interesting that Meng, you just said that the hard part is having those discussions. And now I hear Shilan already saying, well, these discussions are being had.
I'm not saying like there are no discussions happening. I'm just saying like not enough people are getting involved in this kind of discussion. I have to say, unfortunately, that the current discourse on open science is very much quantitatively biased. It's just like, you know, humanities researchers or, you know, for me, like a social scientist, we see the term open science and we don't immediately feel that's relatable. And especially for the humanities. So I think we really need to sort of think about ways and quite easy ways, for example, changing the terms and or trying to sort of initiate a reconceptualization of how we define open science with regards to different disciplines, to different epistemologies, and so that they can feel like, okay, they're welcomed, they're valued, and they should be part of this discussion. So I think that's what I'm trying to push for, and I definitely think there needs to be greater discussion on this. And I'm also glad that Shilan mentioned open data, because I think this is a super fascinating topic. This is one of the topics that the sort of the disciplinary differences are most salient. You really see how people subscribing to different research paradigms view this open data issue differently. For example, for certain sort of qualitative research paradigms, it is not just about the practicality of making data open, but whether like, why should we do this in the first place? And what are the consequences and implications of making the data open? It could very well, for example, change the dynamic between the researcher and the participant, where the participants may no longer feel like this is a safe space for me to, you know, fully express my views, my opinions. And that can change the kind of knowledge we will be able to produce from that type of research. So in that sense, this is even in some cases antithetical to, you know, to our original goal that we wanted to increase the research quality. We wanted to sort of make sure that we're generating valuable knowledge, right? So in those cases, the issue of open data is really more profound or touches upon some of the deeper issues than just the practicality or the technical ability, for example, to anonymize data. So it goes much deeper than that. And I think we should welcome and invite people from those research backgrounds to contribute their expertise, to share with us, you know, how they feel about these kind of issues. And can we reach a consensus, you know, on what are the common values and what might be some of the feasible ways that we can get there?
So do you feel like for your careers that the work that you're doing, and of course, this is the feeling, less a knowing, because you're in early stages of your careers. Do you feel like this is going to pay off?
Yeah, I wish I could say the incentive system is changing fast enough for me to for me to enjoy the benefit. But unfortunately, I have this feeling like, you know, this type of change do take time. And especially for people doing this in, I think we're already sort of in a slightly better state than people in early years, you know, for example. I can't imagine the kind of pressure they were under or the struggle they had to face, you know, between their personal, you know, career development and the sort of the values they hold dear. So the misalignment between, you know, what is good for the scientist and what is good for science is really, or was even more severe back in the days. So we're already in a slightly better position nowadays, but I would say some people are more lucky than others. They are sort of in a field that's more open to, you know, to open science, that they're changing things faster. And in other fields, this type of changes are still sort of in very early stage, and it may take many, many years before, you know, everybody could reap the benefit of that. This is what I believe in. This is sort of aligning with my personal values, and I see that as a way for me to keep my faith in this whole endeavor. So, of course, I need to face the realistic demands or expectations on me to publish in certain journals, you know, or publish a certain number of papers each year or something like that. But in the meantime, I also think it is important to do what you believe in.
Shilan, do you feel like it's paying off for your career?
Yeah, to be very frank, I'm not sure my open science activities pay off directly. I don't think I will be more likely to get a job or be well evaluated because I take time out of my day to diffuse open science practices. I think some people around me wonder why I'm not spending that time doing research. But it does pay off for me indirectly, in my opinion. One, in the sense that I think and hope I'm becoming a stronger researcher through open science practices. So I let what I learned through open science influence my experimental research. And second, I completely agree with everything that Meng just said about aligning with your personal values. So I like my work much more, to be honest. I started my PhD and experiments used to give me a massive amount of existential dread. I found them very scary because I felt like there were an infinite amount of moderators and explanations for what I was doing. I felt very icky about the degrees of freedom I had. There were just many things that kept me from enjoying my work. And it wasn't until I started implementing open science practices into my own work that I noticed, okay, this feels a bit more true to how I want to do research, and it's really made me much more motivated and productive as a result. So at the very least, I think that open science may have indirectly benefited me.
You especially, you've been working in big team science projects, and it seems like both of you are very excited about it. And I wonder whether some of that excitement might rub off on our listeners, because I know that it's still a rare thing for people to be a part of a big team science project, whether it's because it's too much work to apply for funding with multiple institutions or for other reasons.
I think I've gotten two things primarily from doing big team science projects. One is the community, to be honest. It's amazing to be connected to hundreds of researchers at different institutions in different continents. The second thing, I think more of a substantive benefit that I've perceived from doing big team science, I feel like when you're doing experimental science, you often get pushback when you're presenting things or when you're publishing papers on, you know, the boundary conditions and to what extent it generalizes across different cultures and different countries and different languages. And to me, that's been truly amazing, is the fact that we can finally start answering some of those questions. Like, those are really big questions, whether, you know, the fundamental attribution error works the same way for every single individual on Earth, which is kind of what we used to assume, even though we used to only run those studies on North American college students between 19 and 23 years old, who are highly educated, non-religious, et cetera, right? And so now we can start taking a look at moderators and demographics and how they impact our research findings. And so for me, it's really been a way to kind of rebuild the foundations of the field that I'm in and to find out to what extent those foundations actually hold, which has been fascinating to me.
Yeah, first of all, I have to say that it really resonates with me a lot what Shilan just mentioned, especially the, you know, the sense of community. So I sort of first got involved with the Fort project near the beginning of the pandemic. And that's when I started, you know, using Twitter more and stuff like that. And as you can see, you know, this kind of involvement actually not only deepens my knowledge about, you know, the research process and what science means, etc., but also, you know, helps, you know, for me to sort of gain a sense of connection with the world that's out there, and help me, you know, really help me sort of with my mental health as well during this very challenging, you know, past 3 years or so. So that's definitely a big plus for a big team or for a community, especially the ECR communities, such as Ford's, which actually brings me to another point. I feel like I'm personally interested in research methods, and I think mass collaboration or crowdsourcing can be a really valuable research method that can help us advance knowledge in ways that are different from, you know, how it was traditionally done, at least in my field. So I think that's why I'm so, I've been involved in quite a number of projects in Ford, because I wanted to learn, like, you know, what are the sort of benefits, what are some of the pitfalls or challenges in this kind of model, and how can we optimize this model, and how can we apply it to our own research, to our own research field.
The podcast ends and they go like, the day continues. What would be one practical thing what you would invite people to do so that by the time they've heard from both of you, that they'll be like, ah, oh, you know, tomorrow I'll try this.
So if we go back to the community aspect of this, I think Meng and I will agree on this one thing, is to join the Ford Slack. That is the one way I think I've become, you know, part of so many big team science projects, and it's just the resources out there, the support, the community, it's wonderful. So it's one very easy step that has, I think, consequences for a long time.
Okay, so join Ford. And Meng, what do you add to that? Another join Ford? So just do it twice?
First of all, another join Ford. And the other thing, perhaps, I don't know, I think there's a lot of discussion happening on Twitter. I think Twitter is the place like where many of the sort of the discussion on open science is compared with other sort of social media platforms. And also, I think when it comes to research, for example, you don't need to think like, okay, oh my God, I need to do a replication study, or, oh, I need to, you know, do this register report that's going to, you know, take rounds of review or front load, you know, everything. And it's going to be drastically different for, you know, from how I learned how to do things. You can just start by sharing, you know, preprint or even postprint. And that can be a really sort of small step, but can ease you, your way into this whole world of open science. So I think don't sort of try to, you know, try to do everything in one go and start really, really small. Yeah.
You just listened to an original interview here on the second season of The Open Update with Meng Liu and Shilan Al-Zahawi. What did you think? What insights came to mind and what resonated? But also, what did you disagree with? I would love to hear from you, our listeners of the show, because this isn't just a conversation on a podcast. It's a conversation for us all. So leave us a voice message through the link in the show notes. It doesn't need to be a perfect voice message. By sending us a voice message, you'll also take part in our lottery to win a copy of the book Ways of Being by our previous guest, James Bridle. But be sure to include a way for us to get in touch with you so that if you win, we can actually contact you. For now, have a good rest of your day. Take it easy. Next week, we'll be back with our final interview of the series of the second season with Caitlin Thaney, where we'll talk about how we can think, do, and build open into our everyday to improve the future.